the new developments in the Karen Reed murder trial.
This has been a wild turn of events.
I've seen a lot of things. I've never seen anything like this. This case never ceases to amaze me.
It's a spectacle, that's for sure.
It was a hung jury, so no verdict, no real ending to this case.
Karen Reed was back in court where a date was set for her to be tried once again.
There are a lot of issues in this case.
Proctor was improperly searching Karen Reed's cell phone for nude photos.
Michael Proctor, the lead investigator,
relieved of his duties.
It's always the theories that each side will put forth for a jury to decide which one is more believable.
Karen Reed was drunk and angry and hit and killed John O'Keefe when she gunned it in the snowstorm.
Karen, did you ever say I hit him?
I did not.
There are more people here at the beginning of this than at the beginning of Johnny Depp's trial.
We're not concerned about any of the witnesses. None of the Commonwealth's witnesses are concerning us.
And once again, there was drama outside court.
There is a whole new set of legal troubles for Karen Reed. She is now facing a wrongful death lawsuit.
The lawsuit alleges that Karen Reed was drunk and reckless when she hit John O'Keefe.
It's not just Reed being sued here. The family also suing the two Canton bars from that night.
The two bars are liable for overserving her.
The FBI is investigating an investigation of a murder. That never, ever happens.
At this point, multiple jurors have been reaching out to both sides, saying that they are certain Karen Reed is not a killer.
I did not kill John O'Keefe. I've never harmed a hair on John O'Keefe's head.
We're looking at arm injuries with scratches. We're not looking at tire tracks.
There are 17 jurors, and they are coming and going with a police escort.
The investigation wasn't thorough.
This can't be good for the prosecution moving forward.
I just hope justice is served for either one, whatever it is, you know?
The fate of her life is not in her hands anymore. It's not in the hands of her attorneys. It's not in the hands of the prosecutor. It's in the hands of the jury now.
In the last episode, we made it a little more than halfway through week three. Thursday and Friday consisted of one witness and one witness only, and even that wasn't long enough to cover everything that needed to be covered. While everyone has waited eagerly to hear from Proctor, the announcement came last week that the Commonwealth won't be calling him, leaving all lead investigative questions to his partner and supervisor, Sergeant Yuri Bukinik. Proctor was relieved of duty for state police the same day the first trial ended in a mistrial. A week later, the announcement came that he had been suspended without pay pending investigation, and the investigation resulted in his termination, dishonorable discharge, in March of this year, right as the trial was getting ready to start. Although Proctor's name and his termination have been brought up by the defense multiple times, even in opening statements, the jury has heard pretty much nothing about him from the prosecution. It seems like Brennan is hoping to just kind of ignore that huge bruise on his case, or, as Alan Jackson called it in opening statements, their Achilles heel. But having the lead investigator fired for his conduct in this case, that's a big deal, and it's huge for the defense. So they have made sure not to ignore it. Bukinik was called to the stand at the beginning of Thursday in week three, day 12 of trial, and he spent the entirety of days 12, 13, and 14 on the stand. It appeared that Brennan wanted the jury to focus on Bukinik as the face of the investigation, making every effort to minimize Proctor's involvement, to the point where multiple witnesses have even refused to acknowledge that Proctor was the lead investigator. Here's Bukinik on the stand, doing everything he can to avoid that very question.
Would you agree with me that Michael Proctor was the lead investigator as well as the case agent in charge of this case?
He was assigned as the case officer for the case.
Would you agree with me that he had a leadership role insofar as the investigation of the case was concerned?
I wouldn't call it a leadership role. It's more of a facilitator, a liaison between the DA's personnel within the office and the state police. He also helps facilitate any missions, outstanding tasks that need to be completed.
Every case has some lead trooper in your unit, correct? Every case is assigned to someone to sort of be in charge and lead the charge of the investigation. Is that right?
Every case has a case officer that manages the investigation.
Did the team in this case, in this investigation, have a leader? Someone who was assigned as the lead case agent. Not just another officer, not just another detective, but the lead case agent.
The case officer for the investigation was Michael Proctor.
But you don't want to say lead case agent or case officer, correct?
I refer to that billet as case officer.
So this is the same song and dance that we saw Gallagher do when discussing Proctor as the lead investigator. It's almost like the witnesses have been instructed not to say that Proctor was the lead and to minimize everything he had to do with the case. But everyone already knows that Proctor was the lead investigator, and no matter how much Brennan tries to twist that into another version of reality, it doesn't change the facts. Even the trial board findings acknowledge this. It's in writing in their findings report that Proctor failed to conform to the work standards established, quote, while assigned as the lead investigator in a homicide investigation, end quote. And try as they might, the prosecution can't just gloss over that huge issue. And if they were hoping to present Buchanek as the fully capable supervisor, minimizing Proctor's involvement, their attempt may have failed after multiple issues on the stand, like Buchanek working overtime trying to avoid answering simple questions from the defense, presenting John O'Keefe's right shoe to the jury, telling them that this was the one found at 34 Fairview, when Trooper Keefe presented the left one the day before and said that that was the one found at Fairview. Wasting hours of the jurors' time by deflecting and being evasive, even asking for a dictionary to define the word theory, which he had just used in a sentence right before that.
A theory would be, why is the cocktail glass broken? Because it came into contact with the victim. So that's why my information communicated to the ME's office was a possible domestic involving a glass strike to the victim.
So the answer to my question, Sergeant, is you were working off of a theory, correct? Yes or no?
We were working off a report of an injured male party, and then we developed the information, collected the evidence, and developed the investigation.
Do you know what the word theory means?
I'm sorry, English is like a third language for me, so if you can bring up the Webster's Dictionary, I can read it out.
You want me to pull up the Webster's Dictionary? You want to take a break real quick and pull up the Webster's Dictionary to define a word that you used in an answer about 40 seconds ago? We're working off of a theory, quote unquote. You said it, not me. You want me to go get a dictionary so we can figure out for the jurors what that word means?
Objection.
All right, sustain. Let's move along, please.
But before we dive into the issues with this testimony, let's first take a look at the version of Yuri Buchanek that the prosecution presented to the jury. Buchanek took the stand at the start of day 12 and gave his background. He's a sergeant with the Massachusetts State Police, born in Ukraine, immigrated to the Boston area at 9 years old, and attended public school there. He joined the U.S. Marine Corps, and Brennan asked him to explain why. He said after 9/11, he and his friends decided to serve. His specialty was military police, he received top secret clearance, and worked special assignments like the presidential helicopter. Brennan sets up Buchanek's background in the same way that he set up Jen McCabe's. Look at all the reasons you should trust me. He didn't seem to have issues answering questions, he was able to remember everything that he was asked, and he didn't avoid answering anything that Hank Brennan asked him. His answers often seemed overly rehearsed and robotic, but that could just be because I've seen the other side of him and was comparing his demeanor to that version of Buchanek, a version that the jury had not been introduced to yet. Yet. A few things were clear on direct testimony. One of those things, which was glaringly obvious, is that Buchanek was there to minimize Proctor's role in the investigation. I mentioned that he wouldn't refer to him as the lead investigator, but it went far beyond that. You could tell with questioning that both Brennan and Buchanek were wanting to distance Proctor from the investigation, although Buchanek struggled with it at times. He had issues explaining what he did. He instinctively resorted back to saying, we did this or we did that, and Brennan had to keep reminding him not to testify about what Proctor did, only say what he did, even when it was the two of them doing something together. Another thing that seemed pretty clear on direct testimony is that Brennan and Buchanan wanted to try to get ahead of the defense's Bowdoin defense. Now, we've talked about it before, but a Bowdoin defense is basically saying that there were certain suspects or leads that police knew about and should have pursued, but didn't. For example, Brian Higgins, who we'll talk more about in this episode. The defense wants to show the jury that the investigators had tunnel vision and didn't bother checking out anything else besides what they had already decided. They had their sights set on Karen Reed. The prosecution wants to show the jury that the investigators did a thorough job, and they want to give excuses or reasons why they didn't need to look into anyone else. Overall, the direct testimony of Buchanan probably went okay for a jury who doesn't have context to a lot of this stuff and doesn't really know some of what was happening. Brennan spent a lot of time feeding Buchanan answers with leading questions like this one.
Prior to our arrival to Dighton, the theory had changed.
Based on information you received from Jennifer McCabe?
Objection.
Sustained.
What was that based on?
It was based on information I received from Jennifer McCabe's phone conversation.
That's really frustrating and also not supposed to be happening, but it continues to happen nonstop. Brennan knows it's suspicious that pieces of taillight were found at different times, even after the snow had melted. So at one point, he asks, did you search the entire yard on that day? Kind of giving Buchanan a reason to explain this away. And when the gross texts from Proctor were introduced about looking for nudes on Karen Reed's phone, he feeds Buchanan another easy out, asking, did you even read all of those texts? And Buchanan says no, he was working and he was busy. More on that later. But even with Brennan feeding him answers, Buchanan still had some struggles on the stand during direct examination. For example, I mentioned the shoe thing. We heard from Trooper Connor Keefe that he retrieved John O'Keefe's left shoe from 34 Fairview Road during the CERT search. Now, Buchanan was on the stand testifying about the clothing that he had collected from the hospital where John O'Keefe was, and he pulled up an evidence bag with a right shoe that he holds up for the jury. Brennan asked him if this is the shoe that he retrieved from the hospital. But Buchanan, after looking at the evidence bag to read it, says, no, it's from 34 Fairview. Court ends up taking an extended break so they can get it together, and when they come back, he holds up the right shoe again. This time, he says, yes, it is the one from the hospital. Not a great way to show jurors they can trust you. But if there were any questions about how much credibility Buchanan had during direct questioning by Brennan, I have a feeling it may have plummeted a good bit once cross-examination by Alan Jackson began. Buchanan became evasive, going out of his way to avoid answering even simple foundational questions. And he often rambled robotically as if trying to figure out what to say in the moment, but not wanting to commit to saying anything at all. I can't help but wonder how the jury felt during this. It's very similar to what Jen McCabe did on the stand as well, going around and around about simple things, wasting time, arguing over semantics while claiming that you don't want to argue over semantics. By the way, Buchanan literally said that. He said he isn't going to argue over semantics, and then he spends 3 days doing exactly that. Jackson said something about the trial being televised, but Buchanan said he didn't think it was televised, he just knows it was streamed. Jackson says something about the Alberts getting rid of Chloe, and he says they didn't get rid of her, they gave her up for adoption. The list goes on and on. But what message does that send to jurors? Being open and easy on direct, and then evasive and long-winded on cross. And one answer that he did give with no hesitation on cross-examination is probably the main one that he shouldn't have answered. Well, at least not how he did. We'll be right back after this. I am a warm weather girl. I love warm weather outside. I love it when it's sunny and beautiful. But once the temperatures started rising, I kind of realized I'm back in that same worn out rotation. Same tank, same shorts, same sundress, same everything. So this year, I decided to give my daily uniform an upgrade with Quince. Their pieces are easy, elevated, and somehow make me feel so much more put together, but without even trying. Like 100% European linen shorts and dresses from $30, luxe swimwear, Italian leather platform sandals, and so much more. And the best part, everything with Quince is priced 50 to 80% less than what you'd find with similar brands. By working directly with top artisans and cutting out the middleman, Quince gives you luxury without the markup. And Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing practices and premium fabrics and finishes. Another must-have for spring and summer are sunglasses. And I got the cutest aviator lenses off of Quince, and I loved them so much I even ordered my husband some, and I get so many compliments on them. And they are so much less expensive than the ones that I was looking at from a similar brand. Treat your closet to a little summer glow up with Quince. Go to quince.com/brandy for free shipping on your order and 365-day returns. That's quince.com/brandy to get free shipping and 365-day returns. quince.com/brandy. Before we even get into everything else in this testimony, let's get into the Proctor of it all. Former Trooper Michael Proctor was obviously the lead investigator in this case and has a hand in just about every single part of it. It's expected for the lead investigator to take the stand at trial. It's pretty much a no-brainer, and it's often the last witness called by the prosecutors, the one who comes in and wraps up the entire case and walks the jury through their investigation, the evidence they collected, and how they determined who was at fault. It's different in a case where the lead investigator is also the reason that so many people don't trust anything about the case. If the prosecution calls Proctor to the stand, that opens him up to a wide range of questions during cross. And based on how brutal the cross-examination of Proctor was at last year's trial, it seems like that's a risk Brennan doesn't want to take. So he said he isn't going to call him, which also presents a risk. Keep in mind, the jury has already heard about Proctor being the lead, and Jackson has already said that he was fired for his conduct in this case. So by not calling him, you risk the jurors wondering, what else are they hiding from us? But with Proctor not here to answer for what was done, that leaves Buchanek, his supervisor and partner. But is that a risk that will pay off? Or could it have backfired? When Alan Jackson began his cross-examination, he started out with asking about Proctor being the lead, and I've already shared that clip of how that went. But then Jackson asked Buchanek a question, and Buchanek's answer, well, it was a questionable one.
Let me just ask you this. Do you believe that Michael Proctor, his involvement in this case, taints the investigation? Tainted the investigation?
No.
Not at all.
The investigation was done with honor, integrity, and all the evidence pointed in one direction only.
Honor and integrity by Michael Proctor?
Was that a question? I'm sorry.
Sure is. Everything I say is a question. Honor and integrity by Michael Proctor, Sergeant?
Objection. I'll allow it.
The investigation was conducted with honor and integrity, and all the evidence pointed in one direction and one direction only.
So, Sergeant Buchanek, you don't want to answer my question, correct?
I will answer your question, absolutely.
Do you think this case was handled with honor and integrity by Michael Proctor, Sergeant?
The investigation was handled with integrity by Michael Proctor.
Buchanek says Proctor handled the case with integrity, but continues to try to put some distance between the case and Proctor's role in it. Jackson walks through different areas to show how involved he really was, Like, all of the search warrants were from Proctor. Proctor was there from the start. He was there for the interviews. He filled out the evidence paperwork. Video footage that was collected was turned over to Proctor, some of which he did not even turn over to the defense or prosecutors. Like the Higgins videos that we'll watch during Buchanan's testimony. So no matter how much they try to keep Proctor's name off the case, there's really no way to do that. And Jackson made sure that the jury understood that. Brennan made a point to question Buchanan about any connections that he had with any of the Alberts or McCabes, and he said he didn't have any. He knew who some of them were, but didn't hang out with them or socialize or anything like that. I know Brennan was probably trying to show that Buchanan wouldn't have a reason not to be trusted because he's not connected to them, but what does that really imply about Proctor? Jackson also brought up a few issues that came up, like the time of when Proctor and Buchanan went to pick up Karen's car. We know that it was wrong on the report. It listed 5:30 when it was actually 4:12. If it had been 5:30, the taillight theory wouldn't be possible. And the prosecution kind of held on to that time until after the Ring video from Karen's parents' house was shared and proved otherwise. Even then, it was basically brushed off as a Scrivener's error or daylight savings time. Jackson asked Buchanan if he did anything to correct that false information, and he says no, he didn't. But something else that was interesting and kind of not really believable was that Buchanan said Proctor's termination paperwork was basically something he hadn't seen. Now, keep in mind, Proctor reports to Buchanan. But yet, Buchanan says that he doesn't really know why Proctor was fired and hasn't seen the paperwork, other than just the part with the texts that were attached to him, like the group text that he was a part of. So how is that possible? The documents have been made public, and I don't know that you can convince me that he hasn't seen it. We've all seen it. Which brings me to my next issue, Proctor's text messages. With Proctor not taking the stand, the defense has to find another way to bring in text messages that show the bias that they say is at the core of Proctor's termination. Some of those will come in through Buchanan, like the group text that I just mentioned. But some of them, like the ones that he's not a part of, can't just be brought in for Buchanan to read them out loud to the jury. Brennan wants them kept out, of course. I mean, they're bad for his case. And the defense obviously wants them in. The judge has a voir dire in the middle of Buchanan's testimony on day 14 to determine if they can come in or not. Now, these texts include Julie Albert saying that she wants to buy a gift for Proctor when this is all over, but Proctor says just get one for his wife. And it includes the Facebook post where Proctor's mom calls the Alberts their second family. And the text where Proctor is talking about having Julie Albert babysit his kids. Buchanan testifies that before they interviewed Julie and Chris Albert, he asked Proctor how well he knows them. He said that Proctor told him he isn't really close to them, he kind of knows them socially from around town, but it's nothing really. No conflict, no issue. Now, we obviously know that he downplayed this a lot, but Buchanan just took his word for it, never really questioned anything about it. He denies hearing anything otherwise and says that he wasn't in the courtroom when all of these connections were brought up. So by denying any knowledge of the relationship, the judge rules that the texts are inadmissible through Buchanan. The jury isn't allowed to hear them because Buchanan is saying he has no firsthand knowledge of any of that information, which means he can't testify to it. Now, if Proctor is called to the stand by the defense, or if Brennan changes his mind and calls him himself, then they could come in that way. But otherwise, the jury may not know about any of it. But the text that Buchanan was a part of did come in for the jury to hear. It was odd how it was done at first, and I think that that was intentional. Brennan basically introduced them without any context and kind of tried to make it sound like Buchanan wasn't even a part of it. He asked Buchanan if he was included in a text thread and asks where he was when he got it. Buchanan says he was working traffic detail at Logan Airport.
Did you respond?
I acknowledged the text. I did not respond through verbiage.
And during that text chain, did you
look at the entire text chain?
No, the text message came through on my Apple Watch as I was controlling traffic. I glanced at it, took part of the information that came through, and acknowledged it with a thumbs up emoji, indicating that I read it.
At some point, did you learn everything that was on that text chain?
Yes.
Brennan brings up the investigation that was done regarding this text thread. Buchanick lost 5 vacation days for failure to adequately supervise and for the accuracy of a review that he did of Proctor. So Brennan hands Buchanick some papers that he looks at. The jury can't see them. And Brennan asks him if he recognizes that picture. He says no, and then he asks him to read the text.
August 17th, 2022. Funny, I am going through his retarded client's phone.
I'd like you to read all of them, please.
Next one, no nudes so far. I hate that man. I truly hate him.
So Buchanick says all of these are from Proctor. He says he didn't write any of them, and then they just kind of move on. The jury has no idea what the picture Brennan mentioned was of or the context for any of this. But on cross-examination, Jackson makes sure to clear that up. He puts the picture on the screen for the jury, and it's a picture of David Yannetti. Jackson has Buchanick acknowledge that and identify Yannetti, pointing him out in the courtroom. Now the jury knows that the lead investigator is talking about Karen Reed when he refers to his quote-unquote retarded client. And they now know that he was talking about looking through Karen Reed's phone when he said he had not found any nudes yet. Context in this situation is huge. But something else huge in this situation is that Brennan and Buchanick didn't give the jury the whole truth about the text thread. Buchanick played it all off, saying he didn't like the comment. He just gave it a thumbs up to acknowledge he had read it. He was busy, no big deal, right? But Jackson points out that's not accurate. That picture that Buchanick just said he didn't remember when Brennan was asking him about it, well, it turns out he responded to that with a ha-ha. Then when Proctor responded, he liked that comment too. So he was obviously interacting, not just a quick glance down, giving a thumbs up to acknowledge it.
You responded to that photograph, did you not?
Yes, this document indicates so, yes.
And you responded by laughing at it, correct?
That's what it says, yes.
Well, that's what it says, or that's what you did?
I don't remember.
Trooper Proctor then, former Trooper Proctor, Michael Proctor, then responded. And then you responded to the phrase, funny, I'm going through his retarded client's phone, correct?
I acknowledged that text message being sent.
You acknowledged it by liking it, correct? With a thumbs up.
I acknowledged it by responding with a thumbs up emoji.
That's a lot more than just giving something a thumbs up and moving on. He was interacting and just tried to hide it or downplay it. And that destroys credibility for a jury. Jackson asked Buchanick about the misuse of authority and power to go through Karen's phone looking for nudes. And then Jackson asked Buchanick this.
Do you stand by your testimony that Michael Proctor conducted himself during the course of this investigation with integrity?
Yes, I do.
Don't know if I would have doubled down on that one. Jackson asks if Buchanick agrees that the word Proctor used to describe Karen Reed is one of the most vile and insensitive terms that you can use in modern society. And Buchanick says yes. Then Jackson points out that he encouraged it because he liked the comment, gave it a thumbs up. Jackson asks if he thinks that those texts showed honor, and Buchanick says no. Does he think they showed integrity? And Buchanick says no. And just when Buchanick seems to finally be acknowledging that those texts were really messed up, he blows it all with this response.
I believe that as a U.S. citizen, he has the right to comment. That's his First Amendment right. We uphold the Constitution, and it's unfortunate, unprofessional what he said in the private text message communication. He might have been voicing his frustrations. I cannot speak for Michael Proctor. It is unprofessional and unfortunate that he said that.
This was not, Sergeant Buchanick, a private text message conversation. This is with his boss, and four or five other individuals, one of whom was your boss. Correct?
Correct.
He was so close. Buchanick, who has disregarded the First Amendment to arrest people all over the town of Canton for writing their opinions on rubber duckies, is now claiming First Amendment rights for Proctor's gross text messages. But here's the thing. First Amendment may protect our freedom of speech, but the only consequence that it shields us from is government interference. We still have to face all the other consequences that come from our words. We can't cuss out our boss and expect to keep our job. We can't say horrible, insulting things to our friends and expect to still have their friendship. We can't insult and berate our spouse and expect to stay married. And you can't call a defendant retarded and laugh about looking for nudes on her phone to your superior without expecting people to question how you handled yourself. This line of questioning isn't about infringing on Proctor's right to free speech. It's about acknowledging the consequences of the way that he used that right.
We'll be right back after this.
There was something that came out this time around that we didn't hear the first time. Buchanick said that when he got to Canton PD in the morning, he talked to Sergeant Good, who gave him the clear cocktail glass that was found at their search, and John O'Keefe's phone. That's new. Last year and this year, Carrie Roberts testified that she picked up John's phone and put it in her pocket, and then later gave it to a first responder, but she couldn't remember who.
What did you do with John's phone when you picked it up from the ground?
I put it in my pocket and gave it to a first responder when they came over, or I handed it off to a first responder.
There's no chain of custody for the phone, and it's just something that's always drove me crazy. The next thing we heard about it is that Trooper Greeno got it from Proctor so that he could do the extraction. There have always been issues with John O'Keefe's phone and how it was handled, but the chain of custody is one thing that has always bothered me. And hearing that Sergeant Good handed it over at the station made me curious. I have a list of people who I think could have had it, and I narrowed it down based on the step data and what time everyone left Fairview. I had marked Good off the list, and I'll explain why. John O'Keefe's phone was recording steps and getting notifications until almost noon, meaning it wasn't placed in a Faraday bag or put in airplane mode. That's an investigative problem, but that's a whole other story. But because it wasn't done properly, we know a little bit about what was happening with the phone. The steps were recording movement until 8:26 a.m. Then there was a long break with no movement until just after 11 a.m. But if the steps were recording until 8:26, it doesn't really make sense that Good had the phone, because Good left Fairview Road at 7:50, and the phone kept moving for another 36 minutes after that. Then no movement for a while, and when the movement started back up again, it was at 11:06 for about 5 minutes. Then 7 minutes later, at 11:18, it records some steps for around a minute and a half. No movement for the next 36 minutes. Then at 11:56, the last movements are recorded for about 45 seconds. And then the phone seems to be placed into airplane mode at that time. But Buchanick and Proctor couldn't have got the phone from Sergeant Good at that time because they were at Jen McCabe's house. And if they were at Jen McCabe's house, why would they have the phone out over there, putting it in airplane mode? Plus, Good never once mentioned having the phone. This chain of custody has always bothered me. So that had me thinking, if it was put in airplane mode while the troopers were at Jen McCabe's, could they have possibly got the phone from Jen McCabe or Brian Albert or Matt McCabe, since they were there too? There's no steps recorded on John's phone between 8:26 a.m. and 11:06 a.m., like his phone was put down somewhere. Then the steps start back up around the time Jen gets ready to leave Fairview Road to go to her house to meet Proctor and Buchanick. The steps stop for about 7 minutes, which is roughly the time it takes to get to the McCabe house from Fairview Road. It records steps again about the time she arrives home, and then all of those actually line up with the steps on Jen's phone and her location data showing when she left Fairview and arrived home. But then after that, there are no steps on either phone, not hers or John's, for around half an hour. And this is the time when the troopers are there doing their interview. Then, right before noon, steps record again. There's 46 steps on John's phone and 44 steps on Jen's phone. 44 seconds of movement on John's phone, 34 seconds on Jen's. Could be a coincidence, but is it? Or did Buchanick and Proctor actually get the phone from Jen, Matt, or Brian? If they didn't and they got it from Good that morning, that means that someone else got it from Proctor and was doing something with it that entire time while Proctor was gone. And honestly, I'm not really sure which of those would be worse. There's also some other new information that we heard this time around. For example, we heard some new information about Chloe, the Albert's former dog.
At some point during the course of your investigation, did you learn that the Albert family had gotten rid of the dog named Chloe?
We learned that they no longer cared for the dog. I don't know if get rid of is accurate.
Well, they don't have it anymore, right?
Yes.
Okay, so what would you call it?
Giving it up for adoption, I guess? I don't know. I'm not a pet owner. I can tell you when we looked into it officially, I traveled to the dog's home and assisted with identifying the dog and investigating that animal.
So the big question that everyone has been asking since we heard that they found Chloe was, how do we know this is Chloe? So Buchanick says that he verified it with veterinary records. Okay, that would be great, except the vet records didn't come from the Albert family, and they don't have the Albert's name on there. In fact, Chloe's name isn't even Chloe anymore. They renamed her Cora. But it gets even muddier than that. The Alberts apparently gave Chloe to someone with the last name Riley. There's no paperwork on that, no adoption papers, no purchase records, or anything that shows anything about it. But then this Riley person is apparently the one who then gave the dog, formerly known as Chloe, to this new family who then changed her name to Cora. So Buchanick says he wrote a report on all of this. In his report, he doesn't list the name of the new owner or their address, and the vet records don't have Chloe's name or the Albert's name or the new name Cora or the name of the new owner or any vet transfer records. So it's basically like, hey, here's some dog vet records that have absolutely no identifying information about what dog they belong to or who that dog lives with, but it's Chloe. Trust me, bro. Totally makes sense. The other new evidence we got this time around that we didn't have before is the video evidence of Higgins at Canton PD after leaving 34 Fairview. Last year on the stand, Higgins explains that he has multiple cars and he keeps them at Canton PD, including his Dodge Ram that he drove home from New York City that day. He said he got back from New York and swapped over to his Jeep Wrangler, then went out for drinks, then to 34 Fairview, and then went to Canton PD after leaving Fairview so that he could move a couple of cars to the middle of the parking lot so that they could plow.
I had left a key to the surveillance vehicle on top of my desk so that somebody could move the vehicle because a lot of times Chief Berkowitz would get after me. As a courtesy, I was parking vehicles there, sometimes my personal, but primarily my work vehicles. And one thing he asked me, just leave the vehicles in the middle of the parking lot so that snow could be cleared. So the reason for heading back there was to move those vehicles, because if I didn't do it then, I would have had to get up early and do it. And I also know they plow through the night, so...
Now, there was no video surveillance of this last year. It wasn't found or turned over until after the trial, but it was shown during Buchanick's time on the stand. And it was, well, it was interesting. So we see Higgins' Jeep pull into the parking lot at like 1:26, 1:27 a.m. And he parks beside a truck that looks like it could possibly be the Dodge Ram he mentioned. He gets out of the Jeep and puts his hood up, walking away from the Jeep, what we assume is toward the building. But then he stops and he kind of turns back toward the Jeep for a minute. He has his phone in his hand. Then he walks toward the building again. There's another camera that catches him entering the door beside the Sallyport. The footage then cuts to inside the police station, a camera that's set up in a hallway. You can see Higgins with his hoodie still pulled up, and there's a door to his right. He walks in that door and is in there for about a minute and a half and then walks out. So when I first saw this part, I was thinking that was his office. He was grabbing the key to go move the car. But he turned right out of the door, continuing on in the hallway in the direction that he was originally going. And then I realized it wasn't his office. Here's Higgins' testimony from last year.
And so you come into the station, you go by the dispatch, is that correct?
So as I'm walking down the hallway, dispatch would be off to the right. It's a wooden door with two glass panes.
So this perfectly describes the door that we see in the surveillance. Lally also asked Higgins if he saw who was working in dispatch as he, quote unquote, passed by.
And did you happen to go by the dispatch area specifically? And if so, do you know who was working there that night?
Newly promoted Sergeant Good, I believe. Probably. He was on midnights.
Do you have any specific recollection of seeing him there that evening or that early morning when you came by?
I believe I waved to him.
So he believes he waved to him. But I have questions. The video shows Higgins entering the dispatch room and staying in there for about a minute and a half. Y'all, it takes 1 second to wave, not a minute and a half. Now, the defense didn't say much about what he was doing in there because obviously, who are they going to ask? They can't ask Buchanan this, and Higgins isn't taking the stand that we know of. So how do they really clear that up? They did stop on the timestamps to make sure that the jury understood that Higgins did go into that room for about a minute and a half and then came out. But how are they going to address this? I think if I were one of the defense attorneys, I would bring that up maybe in closings. That could be the time when he walks into the dispatch saying, "Hey, if there's a call that comes in, let me know." It doesn't take a minute and a half to wave. And I don't want to be a conspiracy theorist, but, I mean, this kind of goes along with the conspiracy, or at least the cover-up. Higgins continues on in the direction that he was going when he exits, and he's off-screen for about 6 minutes before coming back in view, and then he goes out the way he came. And the video picks back up of Higgins in the parking lot again, walking toward the car. You can clearly see him on his phone again, with the phone lit up and held up to his right ear. He's on the phone. 17 seconds later, he's on a different camera view and still has his right arm bent up like he's holding the phone to his ear. He walks toward the front of the Jeep and then walks in between the Jeep and the truck next to it, then to a car parked in the back of the lot. The door to the car opens around 1:35:50, and he seems to just kind of sit in the car for about a minute. After that, you can see the car pull forward and then pull out of the frame. About 3 minutes later, Higgins is back in view again. He stops at a car that looks like kind of like a truck with one of those camper tops on it, but it could be an SUV. It's hard to make out exactly what's on the video. Higgins testified last year that he has multiple vehicles.
So I would have had my government truck that I parked there. I would have had a surveillance vehicle that I parked there. And at times, it would sometimes flip in and out between a pickup truck that I had and the Jeep itself.
In the video, the Jeep and what I think is the Dodge Ram are parked beside each other. The truck is on the left and the Jeep is on the right, and they're both facing kind of toward the camera. Now, across from the truck that I think is the Dodge Ram is the car that looks like the truck with the camper on it. The two trucks are parked with their front ends facing toward each other, like the grills are close to each other. So Higgins stops at the camper top type truck, and it looks like he's pulling the wipers up on it. and then he walks in between the Jeep and the Dodge Ram. But it's hard to make out what he's doing. We see the passenger door open of the Jeep after a moment, and then he walks from around the back of the Jeep and opens the driver's side door, reaching inside and then closing the door and going back around the back side of the Jeep again. I assume maybe he's grabbing the key to the Dodge Ram because the driver's door of the Ram opens and the lights come on. After a minute, that door shuts and the lights are still on, but Higgins is not in the truck. He actually walks to the camper top truck and opens the passenger door. Now he's reaching in and he's there for like 1 minute before closing that door, walking back to the Jeep again and opening that driver's door again. He reaches inside, then closes that one, walks back to the camper truck again. But this time he doesn't enter. He stands toward the back passenger wheel area for a bit, but you can't really make out what he's doing. Then he goes back again to the driver's side door of the Jeep and then the back of the Jeep, moving around there for a bit and then back to the camper truck again, opening the passenger door and then the back passenger door. Then he walks off behind the truck and he's out of view for about 30 seconds and then back to the driver's side Jeep door again briefly, then back off screen in the opposite direction again, returning about 20 or 30 seconds later with what looks like maybe a snow broom that he puts in the back of his Jeep. He's back in the Jeep again, turns the lights on, and after a moment, he pulls away. There's a lot of back and forth, and it's odd because he said that he was there to move a couple of cars, but he only moved one, and in all the rest of that time, he's just going back and forth between these three vehicles. Now, Higgins is at the police department for a total of about 20 minutes. The first half is inside, the second half is outside, going back and forth between these cars, though it's never made clear exactly what he's doing. Higgins was actually a large part of the testimony of Bukinic. Since Brennan isn't planning on calling him to the stand, a lot of the evidence involving Higgins was brought up through Bukinic. That also includes texts between him and Karen Reed, and surveillance video from the waterfall. The defense is laying out a third-party culprit motive for Higgins, and it starts with the text. Bukinic collected the text from Higgins, who took it upon himself to print his own text and then hand them over to Bukinic. Jackson asked Bukinic if he would consider them flirtatious in nature. Bukinic makes the mistake of saying he can't recall. So Jackson has all 60 pages of text printed out and has Bukinic read each and every one out loud for the jury. It takes more than an hour, and when he first started, it seemed like we were going to be there for a really long time because he was, well, thorough in his reading.
Ha ha. Followed by same person. How did you get my digits? Question mark, question mark, question mark, question mark, question mark. Karen Reed to Brian Higgins. No way, with an emoji. X person holding an X in front of them.
So Judge Cannoti steps in and says he doesn't have to read the punctuation or describe or act out the emojis. Y'all, he literally had his hands like up in front of him in the X, showing the jury which emoji he was describing. They also stipulate to the colors of the text not being read, and they actually have them shown for the jury, and the judge tells him he can just continue from there.
All right, I appreciate that. So you can just read the screen or read what you have in front of you.
Do you want me to start at the beginning or?
No. Let's start where you ended, if you could, please.
And while it started off really rough, at times it kind of seemed like Bukinic was actually like getting into character a little.
Everybody can't stand him. I detest him. OMG, always. What do you like about me? I just feel like you're from my neighborhood. Yeah, ditto. And I think you're hot. You really think that? I have always thought that about you. What? That you're hot, smart, witty. But I didn't think you were interested. Sit on that and spin. See? Now you have to go below the belt. Love it there. Do you wear belts? Only once in a while.
I didn't think it could get any cringier listening to Higgins read these texts last year, but Buchanan's adaptation was definitely worse. But the jury hears the flirtations between Karen and Higgins, and Jackson points out that she kind of stopped talking to him or ghosted him. Then she shows up at Waterfall with John, and he sees her for the first time, and she's with John. Enter the Waterfall surveillance video. Now, this is shown to the jury through Buchanan as well, and right before the group is getting ready to leave Waterfall, the video shows Higgins looking in John O'Keefe's direction, and when it's focused in on him, you can see him with his hand kind of in front of him, motioning, kind of like a come over here type of motion, and it's directly toward John. The action could definitely be interpreted as aggressive, and it even kind of looks like Chris Albert or somebody right there is kind of trying to stand in front of him, almost like holding him back. Now, the same video shows John at the bar, possibly paying the tab, and he looks over in Higgins' direction. Higgins walks out, and it's not long after that that he sent John the text asking if he was coming to Fairview Road or not. Now, for Higgins not having taken the stand, Jackson is actually doing a really good job at laying out a potential motive for third-party culprit. Add all of that to the back and forth in the cars after leaving Fairview, and it's kind of the start of a pretty solid theory. When Jackson asked Buchanan if he thought the texts were flirty, Buchanan said he thinks it was Karen Reed trying to get revenge.
To put a label on the whole thing, my opinion is that she's trying to get revenge.
Get revenge?
Yes, get revenge.
On John?
Yeah.
For what happened on New Year's Eve?
Yes.
Okay. When you say revenge, you don't mean physical revenge.
Well, emotional revenge. She's trying to hook up with Higgins and then hurt John by cheating on him.
The problem that I have with that theory is that John didn't know, so it can't really be used to hurt someone if you never told them that it happened. Buchanan also says that Higgins had no motive to hurt John based on their text conversations. But I mean, there's also an obvious problem with that because, as we know, he didn't tell John everything in those text conversations. John didn't know what Higgins was doing behind his back. Jackson also brings up the conversation that Buchanan had with Higgins, and the jury hears this for the first time.
You were just asked about Brian Higgins in your interview with Brian Higgins. Where did that take place?
In Sharon, at an attorney's office.
At his lawyer's house, correct?
I'm not sure if he resides there, but there was an office.
With his lawyer present, correct?
Yes.
Do you find that unusual?
Objection.
Sustained.
He wasn't under arrest, correct?
No.
You hadn't read him his rights?
No need to know.
No need to, because he wasn't in custody, correct?
Correct.
He was just a witness in a case that you're investigating.
That's correct.
But he asked that you interview him in his lawyer's presence, correct?
Yes.
I'm all for having an attorney when you talk to police, but in this situation, especially because he is a cop, the whole thing does seem a little bit different. A little off, maybe. But the way it's looking, maybe not calling Higgins to the stand has actually been a really good thing for the defense. We'll be right back after this. There are a few other key pieces of evidence that I want to briefly mention. One is the Ring videos. The Commonwealth has insinuated that Karen Reed deleted videos from John's Ring system, and Jackson points out the subpoena from Ring shows activity logs, and those logs have no evidence of Karen Reed ever logging in and accessing anything. But we know that state troopers did. Jackson asked Buchanan if he knows who, and Buchanan says no. But we learned in the last trial that it was Proctor and DeChico. Remember, this was directly from John's Ring app on his phone. not from an extraction. Jackson also asked Buchanick about Lucky and the Ford Edge that he saw. Lucky is the snowplow driver, of course, but Buchanick admits that they didn't even talk to Lucky the snowplow driver until much later, and they didn't investigate the Ford Edge that Lucky said he saw right where John's body was found early that morning. Brennan brings up grass stains on John's jeans, and I don't know if he realizes it, but I don't think that that evidence will work as much in his favor as he's hoping, because he's also arguing that the ground is frozen. If the ground is frozen, I don't think that the grass and dirt would make those types of stains based on what I can find information on. And also, it makes me wonder about the amount of force that he would have to make those grass stains happen. So I'll be interested to see how the prosecution explains that with their crash reconstructionist. I think it's one of those things that we really just need to hear from an expert on. Jackson asks on cross if these grass stains and dirt stains could be from dragging someone. And at first, Buchanick says he doesn't know because he's never dragged someone, which is a stupid answer because you're a detective. But then he changes it up and gives reasons why he thinks it wouldn't be, including linear lines, etc. Jackson also mentions them being maybe grease stains. I think that the theory may be something to do with the garage, based on just some things that Jackson has been asking recently. The inverted video was also played again, and Jackson brought up Buchanick not acknowledging the mirror image and why that's important. He also points out Proctor being near the taillight and the timing being, of course, before the first piece of taillight was found at 34 Fairview. And he points out a zip-up portfolio-type folder that Proctor had in his hand. It makes me wonder about that footage that was apparently found in Proctor's folder that was never turned over. What else does he have in there? The taillight was another big piece of testimony, and Buchanick went through some of the information about the searches and the collection of the different taillight pieces. Now, there are, of course, issues with this, and the world still has a lot of questions about it, like how some of the biggest pieces were found by Proctor literally one day after Buchanick was there, and he didn't see them, but he found some smaller ones. And like how Chief Berkowitz just happened to be driving by on a rainy day with the windows up and saw a piece from the road, then stopped. Why pieces that were found weren't photographed or marked to let anyone know coordinates of where they were found. Buchanick just said they were in a general area, which is about 40 to 50 square feet. Also, it's worth noting that when all of the pieces were put together, they actually are kind of, well, I'll say it like this. Pretty much the entire right side of this taillight was found by Proctor on different days at different times. And then pretty much the entire left side of the taillight was found by Buchanick on different days at different times. Plus one piece from Berkowitz, and then the pieces from the CERT team were all found right under where we know that hole was on Karen Reed's car, the one that she says came from hitting John O'Keefe's car in the driveway that morning. I don't know what the odds are that all of those pieces could be put back together and be sectioned off like that for the people who found them all on different days at different times. Pieces were being found as late as February 18th, and those were big pieces. Brennan asks on redirect if Buchanick inverted the video himself or if he dropped off taillight pieces to be found, and Buchanick laughs at both questions as he says no. Brennan asks things in a way to kind of mock the idea, trying to make it seem absurd to the jury so that they don't believe it. And in turn, Jackson points out that Buchanick actually even called the medical examiner early on, saying this was a domestic situation, thinking that John had been hit in the face with the cocktail glass. Jackson asked what Buchanick did to investigate that further, and the answer was basically just talk to the homeowners. And he says there was no evidence that John O'Keefe ever went in the house. But as Jackson is wrapping up the very end of the testimony, Jackson asks if Buchanick was aware that the step data shows John taking steps that covered 82 feet, about the distance to the house, and Bukinik says no, he had no idea. He wasn't aware of that evidence. It was a long 3 days, but I think overall it was effective for the defense to show some important parts of their theory. And reporters in the courtroom were actually reporting that during some of the ridiculousness, especially throughout the investigation stuff, some of the jurors were like openly laughing. Tuesday was supposed to be the start of day 15, but as the attorneys arrived at court, they were told court had to be canceled for the day. Karen Reed is apparently having health issues and unable to make it. Brennan filed a motion this week also, wanting to now include the Aruba argument that he said he was going to exclude. It's a ridiculous argument, in my opinion. I think he just wants to have the Sullivan sisters come in and say again how they don't like Karen and they think she sucks. I think he just wants more character evidence against Karen. That's been a big part of his MO. I mean, the jury has heard from everyone Brennan could find who didn't have anything good to say about Karen, but they still haven't even heard how John died or how his injuries make sense with a car collision. We are now halfway through week 4, and there's still a lot of loose ends the prosecution has to tie up. So wasting time with gossip from a month before John's death isn't how I would spend my time. But I'm not an attorney. I'm just a 13th juror. My name is Brandi Churchwell, creator of 13th Juror Podcast. If you're enjoying it, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts and Spotify, and share this episode with your friends. For more information, photos, and episode guides, visit our website at 13thjurorpodcast.com.